We'll pick up the countdown shortly here. In H minus 10 seconds, the countdown will come directly from the timing and firing trailer.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Quantel, opt-in, opt-in, go tape.
This is Publius bringing you A Step Farther Out. Your weekly radio message from the Man and Atom Society.
And I have decided that it might be a good idea to point out that this show is coming to you on the 5th of February, 2022. So what do I have to talk about this week? You know, I'm not feeling the best organized that I ever have been. But I'm sure I have useful things to say. The first thing I'm going to say is I continue to be baffled and dismayed by the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, which I have sometimes referred to as the National Agency for Space Avoidance. They say now that they're going to retire the International Space Station in 2030. This, in and of itself, is not terribly surprising or problematic. The Russians are saying that they're going to pull out in 2025, possibly to cooperate with the Chinese on their new space station, shiny new hotness, or possibly to go it alone, although how successful they're going to be, I don't know. I mean, presumably the idea is that essentially when the ISS got started, part of the reason we got anything resembling a space station at all after 20 years of faffing about was simply that with the collapse of the Soviet Union, there was a great fear that the Soviet rocket scientists would go to work for Iran and North Korea and so on. So the United States basically said, we've got a great new idea. We're going to do an international space station, which is going to have U.S. components and Russian components, and this is going to give us an excuse to pump a bunch of money over to the Russian Space Agency so that they can afford to keep their people and not let them go to Iran and North Korea and build missiles, which basically is the only other job opportunity they're going to have. Now, of course, there is the interesting question of what might otherwise have happened, because they might not have gone to Iran and North Korea. They might, for example, have gone to Brazil. The United States, you may not be aware of this, the United States has spent years doing everything it possibly can to interfere with the Brazilian space program. I mean, just as an example, there was a plan to launch Ukrainian Zenit launch vehicles from the Brazilian launch center at Alcantara, which is pretty much right on the equator. It's really ideal for things like geostationary launches. And the United States stepped in to make sure that that would not happen. The excuse for this, as always, just as with nuclear energy, is that, well, you know, there's a lot of commonality between space launch vehicles and ballistic missiles. If you learn to do one, you can learn to do the other, and then you can threaten the world just like we do, and we can't have that. You know, I don't think anybody in the U.S. has quite realized that hardly anybody else, I mean, the confrontation between the United States and the Stalin-era Soviet Union at the end of the Second World War was something sort of historically unique, which set up a situation which is unlikely to be occurring anywhere else at this given time. Nobody else really has a motive for wanting to have 40,000 nuclear missiles pointed at, you know, other places ready to destroy all cities at the push of a button. I'm not sure the United States ever had a valid motive for that. I'm not sure the Russians ever had a valid motive for that, but sure as hell, hardly anybody else does. I mean, the Chinese might try it because they've been breathing the wrong kind of gas for too long, but seriously. Anyway, what was I talking about? Oh, yes, NASA's inexplicable need to immediately destroy anything it doesn't have a use for right now. And that's pretty worrisome, okay? So they say that, well, ISS isn't going to be needed because commercial industry, private industry is ready to take over functions in low Earth orbit, near Earth space. That in itself is perfectly legitimate, okay? That's a perfectly reasonable thing to say. I have no quarrel with that. But then they say, we're going to drop the ISS in the Pacific Ocean. Bitch! So, if there's one thing that private industry is going to want, it's going to be to not have to carry up into orbit every single bleeding gram, every single bleeding bolt and nut, right? Even after it's past the end of its service life and the modules are all full of black mold, because that happens, and all that other stuff, the salvage value of hundreds of tons just of material, much less the fact that much of it is made up of valuable components, salvageable pumps and valves, circuit breakers and wiring, tubing, all that kind of thing, right? Salvageable. There could be no greater impetus to commercial private industry in near-Earth space than boosting the ISS up into a disposal orbit, a slightly higher orbit where it's not likely to intersect people's comsat constellations, but it's also not likely to fall into the atmosphere within a month in an uncontrolled manner, right? Boost it up there and say, all right, it is now free for all. Salvage operations, have at ye. But the second part of that, right, I mean, we could say this about the Hubble Space Telescope, but the Hubble is much smaller. But, you know, the second part of that, I don't know. I just don't understand it. It was literally decades, literally more than $100 billion. Because, of course, they insisted on launching the ISS components on space shuttle missions, which is really, no, not a good idea, right? Shuttle was originally conceived of to primarily resupply. Not to mention it was originally conceived of for a much higher flight rate. 50 flights a year, not 130 flights over 30 years, right? They average just about 5 flights a year, which is no way to run a railroad, as the saying goes. Anyway, now they want to take, you know, all those hundreds of billions of dollars, all that blood, sweat, toil, and tears, and just drop it into the Pacific Ocean. And it reminds me of the fact that, as part of that quid pro quo with the Russians, yeah, so the Mir space station, of course, had become essentially derelict. Parts of it had failed in fairly dangerous ways. There was a fire on board, etc. So the Russians were prepared to abandon it, right? But they didn't really have a plan. Anyway, some folks, mostly in the U.S., came along and formed a corporation they called Mir Corp, and they bought it. And then they paid for a Soyuz mission to go up and reactivate it. And they were going to use it for private industry commercial activities in near-Earth space in low-Earth orbit, right? Yet NASA told the Russians, oh, by the way, as a condition of participating in the ISS program and getting all this lovely cash we're prepared to fork over to you, you have to dump the Mir into the ocean. So they basically stole all the money that the people had spent buying the Mir and reactivating it. NASA basically stole that money from them. Which, of course, was a colossal setback to commercialization and private industry in near-Earth space. It was incredible. Of course, that was also the period during which, in the U.S., if you were going to try and buy seat on a Soyuz to go into space, you could be arrested. People were. There was a group down in Houston who had the brilliant idea that they were going to run a raffle. They were going to organize a raffle and sell tickets, and they were going to buy a seat on a Soyuz, and then they were going to, you know, raffle that off. And they had the idea that this would really raise popular interest in space. They got arrested. They were released after a few weeks because there was actually no reason to hold them, but their whole plan was disrupted. And people got the impression they'd been doing something criminal. Matter of fact, Dennis Tito, the first American space tourist who went up on a Soyuz, was denounced on the floor of the United States Senate as unpatriotic because if NASA didn't want to take American civilians into space, well, they damn well better not go. That still makes me mad. So, yeah, I'm not really sanguine about NASA's plan to waste decades of effort and hundreds of billions of dollars. Not that they haven't already done that. I mean, for example, the large centrifuge facility, which would have been the single most interesting and valuable scientific experiment on the ISS. It was fabricated. Japan, if I recall correctly, contributed that part. It was sent to Houston. It was sent on to KSC, all right, sent to Cape Canaveral to be loaded onto the space shuttle. And then it was quietly demanifested. Just marked off the list. That's not going to be flown. That's not going to be taken and incorporated in the ISS. The official rationale was that the vibrations created by the centrifuge would make certain kinds of crystallography experiments more difficult. And that may or may not be true, but the ability to do biology experiments in variable gravity would have been one of the single most interesting scientific things you could have done on the ISS. And considering the ISS has been restricted to pure science activities, essentially, right? It doesn't have any kind of facilities for assembling spacecraft, which is, generally speaking, one of the concepts you associate with a space station. It doesn't have any kind of facilities for refueling spacecraft, servicing spacecraft, any kind of that sort of thing. It doesn't have orbital transfer vehicles to go out and grab satellites, bring them back so people can work on them in a controlled environment and put them back in their original orbit, right? It doesn't have orbital transfer vehicles so servicemen can go out and fix malfunctioning satellites. It doesn't have any of that kind of thing. All it does is pure science, right? So simply saying, well, we're not going to do this particular science experiment, when it's the one science experiment that everyone agrees would be the most valuable, not only in terms of our general understanding of biology, but also if we want to send people to Mars, if we want to send people to the moon long term, that kind of thing. Just quietly striking that from the list after the Japanese have put, you know, many years and quite an enormous sum of money into fabricating it and testing it and qualifying it, all those kinds of things. You really have to ask yourself, who was making the decisions here? Something similar can probably be said for the solar thermal power plant, although that had a really complicated history. It started out back in the 1970s. This is the Brayton Isotope Power System. The idea was to have like a 30 to 100 kilowatt power generator powered by a radioisotope source. And of course, we'd had the radioisotope thermoelectric generators, but those have very low efficiency. They're like 3% efficient in terms of heat to electrical conversion. So the idea was you could take the very same heat source and couple it to a more efficient heat to electricity converter and have a much bigger power source. Great idea, right? Saves on expensive plutonium-238, which is very hard to get, that kind of thing. Good plan. And so the thing was actually built, and it was tested in vacuum chambers and NASA research facilities, and worked pretty successfully, but this was the 70s. The U.S. was pulling back from major space projects. It was shelved. It was put in a storage closet, essentially. Then in the 90s, it was pulled out again and redesigned as a solar Brayton power system. And basically what they did was they replaced the isotope heat source with a big mirror concentrator and a bunch of salt in little tubes. And the idea was the mirror concentrator would heat up the salt, and then the gas would flow over the salt and pick up the heat. And the idea was that in low Earth orbit, typically, you have a cycle, and it's like 50 minutes of daylight followed by 40 minutes of darkness. on average. And so the concept was that you use the salt to store the heat, and then you have a continuous power output, which meant that unlike with PV panels, you didn't need a bunch of batteries. And since the heat to energy, the heat to electricity conversion of the Brayton power system was still twice or three times as good as that of PV panels, you wouldn't need as much solar collector area either. Anyway, it was a power system with a completely different set of characteristics from the PV power system. And the idea was that they were going to put it on one of the shuttle missions to Mir and take it up to Mir. But again, it was demanifested from the shuttle launch manifest. Yeah. So, I mean, I have friends and acquaintances, and I know people who will tell you that, you know, basically for the money that NASA has spent on not doing anything, that is to say, on a bunch of paper studies, right? For that, we could have gone to Mars, if not Jupiter, if not Alpha Centauri. And I don't say that's not true. It's disgustingly plausible. And that's the thing, is that we have to remember that NASA's activities are driven by the political necessities of the United States government. And so when people say, well, why are you for all this space commercialization? I mean, you know, Elon Musk is a grifter and Jeff Bezos is an asshole and all this other thing. I say, yes, of course they are. You know, I'm not disputing that. I'm not disputing any of that, right? But here's the thing. They are, for their own reasons, whatever, right? They are creating tools and mechanisms which other people can use. There's a completely different set of levers attached to them than to NASA and government-run space programs. And those may be levers that those of us who care about the future of humanity, those of us who understand that the future of humanity is not a question merely of one little grain of sand in the midst of all this vast cosmic immensity, those may be levers which we can grasp and use. And I'll tell you right now that the people actually working for SpaceX and Blue Origin and these other companies, that's why they're working there. How do I know? Because I've talked to them. I know some of these people. I'm acquainted with a lot more of them, people before they went to work for these companies, right? I know what their ideals and motivations are, okay? A lot of these folks, there's a phrase Rick Tumlinson likes to use. He says, we're all Jerry's kids. If you haven't read The High Frontier by Gerard O'Neill, I strongly suggest that you read it. You know, this is the source of that quotation that I use all the time. You've heard me say it, undoubtedly, either live or in a recording, right? Is a planetary surface the best place for a growing technological civilization? That was a question that Gerry O'Neill, who'd been hired at Princeton to work on particle accelerators, but because it was technically a professor job, he had to teach a course. So they gave him a seminar course, seminar physics course to teach, right? And he had this great idea that he was going to write up some questions, and basically every few weeks he'd give the class another question, and they would all discuss it, and he wouldn't have to do any of that boring professor stuff, right? He could just, you know, basically lead in class discussion and give people participation grades. I mean, at Princeton, so this is still actually, you know, academically not meaningless, but still. But it was the fall semester of 69, and so the first question he gave them was, is a planetary surface the best place for a growing technological civilization? And that question turned out to define the rest of his life. So yeah, I strongly suggest that you read The High Frontier by Gerry O'Neill, and maybe that will give you a sense of just how pathetic, how small and reprehensible all this fighting here on Earth is when we could have what we want, not by taking it away from each other, but by creating it. let's harness the creative energies of humanity, which now includes the ability to unlock the energies inside the atom, to creating, not destroying. If I have a platform, that's it. I'm sick and tired of people who want to fight wars because they're so nearsighted. Not just the harm that war does, okay? War is immensely harmful. It destroys human beings and everything human beings spend their lives building, everything they value, both physically and morally. Okay? War destroys all of that. And for what gain? Nothing. The creative energies, if I had a thesis for this show, it would be simply this: the creative energies of mankind are colossal, and the only fit field for their expression is the cosmos. Perhaps I am just shouting in your ear to no purpose. Perhaps this is a case of Uma no Mimi ni Nembutsu, as the Japanese say, Buddhist prayers whispered into the ear of a horse, which don't go much of anywhere or achieve much of anything. But I hope and pray that you will consider these concepts. Think about it, think about it, think about it. What else is there to say? Of course, you know, I mentioned the unrest in Kazakhstan, and then the power outage, which seems to have been completely unrelated to the unrest in a direct sense. Although, you'll notice, what happens in Kazakhstan? They get unrest. Why? Because of an increase in the price of LPG, propane to us Americans, LPG, which they use as motor fuel over there. Because, of course, they're drilling out a lot of gas. They're liquefying the gas for shipment to other people who really want gas. But they are, nevertheless, they take the heavier fractions and they use them to fuel their cars. See, in com, Adam D. says, I'm still not shopping at Amazon. That's a perfectly fair choice, believe me. I am also not advocating for the people of Rotterdam to modify their harbor in order to allow Jeff Bezos' sail-powered mega yacht to pass easily. Let me point out, by the way, I keep saying that one of the problems with a renewable energy future is that to get lots of renewable energy, you have to be very wealthy, that this creates social stratification. Jeff Bezos buying a gigantic sail-powered mega yacht is kind of a really interesting object lesson of exactly what I mean by this, that in a society which embraces renewable energy as its, you know, guiding light and goal, that you have a few people who have access to a whole lot of it, and most people are engaged in the producing of it and don't have access to much of it at all. You get social stratification. And why do I say this? I mean, for one thing, I say this because this is the pattern that existed right across the world before the introduction of coal. Right? Before the introduction of the steam engine, circa 1700. And that's part of the reason why I was reading from Jivan's The Coal Question on Friday. If you want to go back and listen to that archive, I read what I think are some significant passages. But yeah, Jeff Bezos and his sail-powered mega yacht, a symptom of ostentation. Let's see. So yeah, the unrest in Kazakhstan was very much of a piece with the Gilets Jaunes protests in France a while back, which again were over a proposed carbon tax, which would have increased the price of motor fuel substantially. Because for many people, mobility is really, really important, and if they have to depend on automobiles for their mobility, then the price of motor fuel is going to determine their standard of living. It's going to determine whether they can keep their jobs, perhaps. This is important business. It's serious business. And this is why I say that all carbon tax revenues ought to be devoted to building nuclear power stations. What do I mean, all carbon tax revenues ought to be devoted to the nuclear fuel cycle, to producing nuclear energy? Well, it's very simple, really. If people see that the revenue from the carbon tax is going to go to provide cheaper energy in larger quantities, then there's less likely to be social unrest. There's less likely to be riots. You're less likely to get political opposition to your carbon tax, right? You can decarbonize without throwing your society into chaos. Because that's the key. If your decarbonization path involves social chaos, guess what? It's not going to work. This seems like an obvious lesson, right? That if you're doing something and it provokes a lot of social unrest, you're probably not going to keep doing it. Unfortunately, in many countries, the opponents of nuclear energy succeeded in provoking a lot of social unrest, which resulted in the stopping of nuclear energy in places like Germany. So I really don't know what to do. Other than write to the administrators of nuclear power plants in Germany, which are closing down, asking them if I can get the exhibits from their visitor centers. So I actually got a couple of emails back about that, and I haven't had the courage to read them until now. I think I also started an anti-nuclear dogpile on SDF Mastodon when I insulted a German, you know, who was saying, oh, we need to oppose this horrible thing where the EU is going to define, you know, nuclear energy as sustainable despite its radioactive wastes. And I pointed out that, you know, the European Commission referred the question to the Joint Research Center Petten, which is its expert body on this. And then when Petten said, yes, the nuclear energy satisfies the do-no-harm criterion of the taxonomy at least as well as the energy sources that are explicitly included in it, and better in most cases. Then they said, well, we're not going to accept that because it's politically unacceptable, so we'll punt to an Article 31 group of experts. And the independent expert group endorsed the conclusions of the Petten report line by line. I mean, which no one familiar with the scientific facts would have expected anything different. I mean, people say, oh, well, the nuclear waste is radioactive. Yes, I mean, that's actually the best part about it. Why do I say that? Well, the first thing is, it's radioactive, which means it's constantly undergoing a decay process. It's constantly losing its toxicity. Can you say that about most other categories of industrial waste? No, you cannot. Secondly, I mean, this is cool, right, that fission product wastes from reprocessing nuclear fuel in 300 years have lost basically all their toxicity. That at that point, vitrified fission product wastes from reprocessing plants are less radioactive than ordinary building bricks. And like ordinary building bricks, the only way that you could get significant radiation harm from them is to grind them up and inhale or eat them. And guess what? If you're snorting ground glass, you have problems very far away from radiation poisoning. Jesus, people, get a grip! And of course, we are only talking about 1 gram of fission products produced per megawatt day of heat released, which is a very small amount. And then also, of course, is this fun fact, which was raised by W. Bennett Lewis of Atomic Energy of Canada Limited, the father of the CANDU reactor, who pointed out that in terms of fission product wastes, because of the exponential nature of radioactive decay, and this is really cool, that in a steady state, that is to say, when your production of energy from fission is constant, that the radioactivity of the wastes of the past 20 years is equal to the radioactivity of all the rest of the wastes of all past time. Doesn't matter if you're doing this for 100,000 years, the radioactivity of all your older waste put together is equal to the radioactivity of today's waste, the waste of the past 20 years. That is kind of cool. I find that kind of fascinating. Now, what are they saying? Let's see. Da-di-da-di-da-di-da. Our visitor center will be open to you once the corona pandemic has subsided, probably in early summer 2021. Based on the Atomic Energy Act, we had to shut down our plant on December 31st. We have been operating as a pure dismantling facility. In most other countries outside Germany, nuclear energy is very well recognized and valued. Unfortunately, our country is taking a special path in this respect. That's from Gundremmingen. And thank you very much. Management decided to close their information centers. Bloody, 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 bloody. We do not comment or actively contribute to political...